Okay, so Lovneen, we are recording this for you. sorry you're not here. So we start the class now. Yeah, so today's topic is Hellenistic Judaism and the Greek. Yeah, so it's important to note when we talk about the Hellenistic period, it's about not just the Greek period under Alexander the Great onwards, but it extends to Greek influence, such as under the Romans later on. So a lot of the way that Judaism developed, it not only became Hellenized under strictly Greek rule, but the Greek culture was so influential that also subsequent empires such as the Romans were heavily influenced by Greek culture. So that whole Hellenized period, yeah, starts with, if you look on the time map there, Alexander the Great, and then subsequently after Alexander the Great's great empire collapsed, and it was divided into different areas such as Egypt, and then Syria under the Seleucids. So during that period also, of course, Hellenistic influence continues, because these are different Hellenistic sub-empires of Alexander the Great's once massive empire. And then of course after those also collapsed under the Roman invasion, then of course Roman culture as well has this strong Hellenistic influence still remaining within Roman culture as well. So we can't underestimate how powerful the influence of Greek culture, or Hellenistic culture as it's called, was in both the kind of classical Greek period, and also in the under the Alexander the Great, of course, and then under his subsequent sub-empires that were divided up after his big empire collapsed, and then the Roman Empire, of course. Yeah. So Judaism did not escape this influence, just as many other cultures in the region did not escape the influence. And this is actually, if you look at this picture here, this is quite an interesting kind of embodiment of the influence, or example of the influence. This is from a town. Actually, I live very close to this town. So Nazareth, where Jesus was born, down the road from there, there's a place called Sepphoris in Greek. In Hebrew, it's called Tzipori. So Tzipori is very close, about 5 kilometers from Nazareth. And this was a place where Jewish masons would go, like stone masons, to cut stone for the Roman Empire in their building projects. And then Jesus himself may have been both a carpenter and a stonemason, because often carpenters worked in the same area, as the same field as stonemasons. So they would often do both woodwork and masonry. So if Jesus lived so close to this area, like 5 kilometers from there, some scholars have argued that he most likely would have gone down to Sepphoris also to work as a stonemason in the different building projects there. So coming back to the influence of Greek or Hellenistic culture in this town, yeah, it's very obvious. You can see, of course, the menorah. Menorah is like the 7 candlesticks of Judaism, representing Judaism. And then you have the temple in the middle. Yeah, so kind of a very Hellenistic looking temple with the pointed roof. The different mythical creatures of different animals, mythical Greek animals on either side. And in the middle you have a picture of Diana, which is of course a Greek goddess. So many different elements there you can see of yeah, Greek influence with a Jewish flavor kind of. Yeah. So this is yeah, this is called a mosaic. You know, mosaic is like a picture made up of many different colorful tiles. And yeah, so the mosaics there at Sepphoris or Tsipouri are very impressive. You can see the religious beliefs of the people depicted in those mosaics, the kind of lifestyle that they had. You can see down here, for example, I think it's a farming or agricultural lifestyles of the livelihood that the people are engaged in. Yeah, so very interesting. If you get a chance to go to Israel, that's a kind of a lesser known place that people don't often go to, or they don't know about. I mean, it's very prominent. It's quite an important site. Once you go there, you'll know about it. But if you're not in Israel, often people don't hear about this site, which is actually quite an important, may have been quite an important part of Jesus' life at that time. So, yeah, so today the main topics we are talking about is Hellenistic Judaism in a general sense, Jewish society under Hellenization, so what was it like? Hellenistic cultural influences, Hellenistic Judaism in Palestine. Yeah, so we had Judaism, of course, in both in Palestine and in the diaspora. So we talk about both how it was Hellenized within Israel itself, and then also outside in the diaspora. Then we talk a little bit about, or just an overview of the literature of the diaspora, the literature in Palestine produced by Jewish people, and then key post-exilic and Hellenistic figures in Judaism. Yeah, so yeah, if we look at the strictly Greek period of Hellenistic culture, we're talking about 332 to 63 BCE. So this is after, so during the period when Alexander the Great conquered Palestine. This is 332 BCE, and then incorporated Palestine into Ptolemaic Egypt. So Ptolemaic Egypt, of course, is the Egypt ruled by the Greeks after they conquered the Egyptians and then adapted the role of the pharaoh for the Greeks in the place of the Egyptians, but using the same type of system of governance based on the Egyptian model. Yeah, that is called Ptolemaic Egypt, when Egypt was ruled by the Greeks. And then subsequently, Ptolemaic Egypt was conquered by the Syrian Seleucid dynasty in 198 BCE by King Antiochus III. Yeah, so the Seleucid dynasty was a break-off branch of Alexander the Great's former empire, one of the great kind of sub, or you could, what you could call subsequent empires that branched off from this the great empire, the wider empire of Alexander the Great, which preceded it. So the Syrian Seleucid empire, you could say, stretched all the way from the Levant, which is Israel, Lebanon, part of Syria, all the way across to India, to the border of India, to the Indus Valley in Pakistan. So a very large empire which succeeded Alexander the Great. So under this, so Antiochus III was a ruler at that time, and under both of them, so Alexander the Great and Antiochus, there's more kind of leniency given to the Jews, much as had been the case under Cyrus the First, under Cyrus the Great, who gave, as we said last week, who made that edict that all local satrapies. So satrapies being local forms of governance, they had their own kind of autonomy, but they had to pay him tribute. And this was a similar system continued under Alexander himself, of course, who took over. And then after Alexander, also the Seleucid dynasty used the same type of system. And that kind of satrapy system continued right up to the Muslim period under the Abbasid caliphate. Also, they used the same kind of idea to let local government or local jurisdictions have their own form of autonomy while sending back tribute to the capital, to the center of the empire. Yeah, so both Alexander and Antiochus were known kind of for their liberal treatment of the Jews and allowing them their own constitution through the Torah, which was very important. but at the same time, you had 29 Greek cities in Palestine. So although there was this kind of leniency, Greek culture was subtly creeping in. You had, on the one hand, liberal governance was guaranteed, even a constitution under the Torah, but culturally, Hellenism was so pervasive, simply because, if not for no other reason, because there were so many Hellenistic cities being established in Palestine. So things got worse in 2nd century BCE. Hellenizing Jews took control of the priesthood, and the head priest was Jason. So Jason himself was a Hellenized Jew, and he wanted to influence Jewish culture through Greek culture, and to make Jerusalem this kind of Greek city. And then another personality, Menelaus, who was even more of a Hellenized Jew than he, ousted Jason. And so after this, a civil war erupted between the two factions, the Hellenized Jew and the even more extremely Hellenized Jew. So it wasn't as if there was a division here between those who were strictly Jewish and those who were Hellenized, but instead the degree, it was probably more over power, they're fighting over power rather than the degree of their Jewishness. But in any case, Antiochus intervened. So this is, we're talking about here, Antiochus III. So he sided with Menelaus and banned the practice of Judaism. So as a result of that, a revolt was led by Mattathias in 167 BCE and his five sons. And these five sons and him, they're called the Maccabees, or Hasmoneans. Yeah, so that these rebels are called by this name, the Maccabees, most often known by the name Maccabees, and they established the Hasmonean dynasty. So the Hasmonean dynasty, as we'll see later, was to continue right up to around 100 CE. So what was I going to say about that? I can't remember. Yeah, so this is what is celebrated at Hanukkah. So the Maccabees taking over, revolting in defense of Judaism against Antiochus III. Oh yes, that's what I was going to say. So many scholars have said if there was a continued practice of leniency towards Judaism, like kind of giving Judaism more liberty as they had done before. And so Alexander, as we said before, yeah, so both Alexander the Great and then later on Antiochus III, they had practiced they had given liberty to the Jews, and then if they had continued that, rather than clamping down on Judaism, Judaism would probably have been eradicated because there would have been no opposition and they would have slowly become assimilated and Hellenized. So it's ironic that actually this clamping down, this persecution of Judaism is what actually caused the Jews to protect their religion and therefore to propagate Judaism so that it did not become assimilated. So if that had happened, we would not have had Christianity as well, or Islam. So actually this was a very big event, the revolt led by the Maccabees in the history of Judaism and subsequently other monotheistic religions. Yeah, so the Hellenizers were supported at this time by the wealthy urbanites, and the Maccabees by the peasants and the urban masses. But the interesting thing is the Maccabees themselves, some of them were idol worshippers as well. So it could have been more for political purposes rather than for the preservation of Orthodox Judaism. So more of a political struggle between the urbanites, the rich, wealthy urbanites who were more Hellenized, and those who were less Hellenized and in the countryside, those who were the masses. Yeah. So probably you know this picture of a Chanukiah used for Chanukah. So in Judaism, the main symbol of Judaism, one of the main symbols is the seven candlestick, the seven branched candlestick, which comes from the book of Deuteronomy, where God instructs Moses to create a large seven-branched candlestick for the temple. The exact meaning or symbolism of that is not really clearly known, but people suggest maybe it's to represent the light of God, or of course seven being the perfect number, showing that God created in 6 days, rested on the seventh. There are a few different interpretations about the exact origins of the menorah. But menorah has seven candlesticks, and then the Chanukiah has nine candlesticks. The one in the middle is called the Shamesh. So Shamesh means like a servant, or the one that serves. So this one lights the other eight candlesticks. And this comes from the miracle of Chanukah, where maybe you've heard before. Do you know the story of Chanukah? So it's in it's not actually in the Bible, but it's based on the time when the Maccabees came into the temple, cleared out the Hellenizing Jews and the those who had desecrated the temple, and then they found one casket of oil that had not been desecrated by the Greeks. So the rest had been desecrated because Antiochus Epiphanes is said to have sacrificed a pig in the temple and then spread its blood around, and that was very insulting to the Jews. So everything that had been touched by this blood, or been touched by these Greeks coming to desecrate the temple, was then considered desecrated. So only this last olive oil was not considered to be desecrated. So they used that oil, which should only last for one day, to light the candles for 8 days. And so therefore it's a miracle of Chanukah that it even went beyond the 7 days that it's supposed to, that the normal number of caskets are supposed to last for. But this one casket that was supposed to last for 1 day lasted for 8 days instead. So this is the miracle of Chanukah. These represent the 8 days, and this one is the one in the middle that is said to serve the others. So you use that to light the others. And then they'll play dreidel. So these dreidels, kind of for kids usually, they'll play that. And you spin it, and it's got a different letter of the Hebrew alphabet on it. And I can't exactly recall the significance of that at this moment. But that's it's an interesting game played on Chanukah. Yeah, so this, the miracle of Hanukkah, and then you have, why is that there? So the last point, yeah, I was talking about the Hellenizers being supported by the wealthy urbanites, and this is an example of a very wealthy Hellenized urbanite Jew, but actually living in this is in I think from Alexandria in Egypt. So it's not in Israel where we are talking about, but an example of a thoroughly Hellenized Jew, a businessman working for the local one of the local governors in Egypt. So he's actually an official a sorry a manager of an official in Egypt, working for the government, and he himself he uses pagan terms in this correspondence. So he writes in Hebrew. This is all in ancient Hebrew, but he incorporates many different Greek terms, especially Greek religious terms, pagan terms, and he refers to himself as this very Hellenized Jew. He's very proud of being Hellenized and not so much of his about his Jewish culture. And then his children also, they are even more Hellenized, and then his grandchildren, then they become totally assimilated into history, into Hellenistic history, and leave their Jewish roots. Yeah, so his name was Tobiah. This is just an example of that very strong form of Hellenization taking place at this time. I can't remember why I'm talking about King Herod the Great. Yes, that's why. So King Herod the Great, under his influence, that is when Judaism reached the height of its Hellenization. So the most Hellenistic, the most thoroughly Hellenized period of Judaism happens at this time under Herod the Great or Herod the First of Judea. So this is jumping forward, of course, a little bit beyond the period we were talking about just now, but just to kind of show you the extent to which Judaism was influenced by Hellenistic culture. Yeah, so for example, his palace, this is his palace at Masada in the Judean desert. So he built it on top of this incredible mountain top, which is flat at the top, so a perfect place for his summer retreat. And here you can see in the I think it's the southern face of Masada, that's where his palace was. So on the side, and you've got a it goes you've got steps going right up, so the top, and then down here another part of his palace. So he could lie there in his bath. He's actually found his the kind of hot bath he would have had in that place, overlooking the Dead Sea. So if you look over there, over that way, it's not in the picture very clearly, but the Dead Sea is right here. So imagine have that beautiful view across to the Dead Sea. Yeah, sipping his wine in his hot bath here, and he even had stables. If you look at the top, there's stables for horses. I have no idea how he got them up there, and they would have been there permanently because you can't get down from there. And also store, yeah, not just stables, but granaries to store food for himself and his troops at the top there. So this is interesting. This place was taken over much later in 73 to 74 CE by the zealots, the what's it called, the Jewish zealots who were there. Beyond the period we are talking about, but all of those structures were there for them to be able to live in. They had the whole families up there. I think 2,000 Jewish zealots were held out here, and the Romans had a very difficult time building a ramp. I think over a period of a year, You can't see it in the picture here. I think this is the, yeah, this is the ramp in this, at the southern end. They built this massive ramp up to, right up to the top, and then they used catapults and they were firing non-stop, and then they put ladders from the top of the ramp up to the walls and then jumped over that. But they were, yeah, we'll talk about that in a few weeks to come. But this is the same place where this that event happened, as where Herod the first had his summer retreat there. So yeah, he built this place in Masada. He built great amphitheaters all over the country. Also hippodrome. Hippodrome is like a, you know, horse chariot racing, kind of an amphitheater, but for horse chariot racing. So that was a very Hellenistic form of entertainment. And then also many Greek theaters. All of these kinds of Greek buildings and structures all over Israel. So he was, yeah, as we said, very influential in Hellenizing Israel and Hellenizing Judaism. Yeah, so Jewish society under Hellenization, what did it look like at that time? So we have different parts of society with different members of society, different, you could say, classes in some cases, but more here we are talking about different people with different ideologies, groups with different ideologies, and how different worldviews based on their greater or lesser Hellenization. So priests were the wealthiest and strongest political group in Jerusalem, especially the Oniad family. So they were overseeing not only the temple, but the wealth that was coming into the temple. They were kind of like bankers, if you like. They were very rich, and they saw not only donations, but individual deposits at the temple. They were in charge of all the money coming in and out of the temple. Then you had priests. Pharisees. The Pharisees were, they were kind of a separatist group that evolved from the scribes of Soferim. So Soferim in Hebrew means scribes, and especially the Hasidim. Hasidim in Hebrew means like those who are pious, so the pious ones. So they were known as the pious practitioners of Judaism. So they were opposed to this kind of rich monopoly by the priests. So they were kind of, that's why they call separatists, because they were opposed to this monopoly of wealth and use of the temple as a bank rather than a place of worship for God. And they were supported by the lower classes. Yeah, so the lower classes, not the... So it's actually quite interesting, because in the New Testament, you often get the picture that they are... kind of not supported by the lower classes, that they are the elite of Judaism. But actually the Bible, if you look at the New Testament, it doesn't portray them like that, as being this elitist social class, but instead their ideas are kind of lofty and disconnected from the masses. That's more the angle, but certainly that's the picture I had in my mind before, that they are this kind of both spiritually and materially elitist group that separates itself from the people, but more they were against the upper class of the priests, who were the ones in control of the material wealth of Israel. It's important to know that this is not normative Judaism, as one's claimed. So often people think of the Pharisees as representing normative Judaism, but instead they are a separatist group that was kind of a minority to an extent. They never, I think there was something like 6,000 of them in Israel, so not a huge number. So spread out across Israel, maybe more in pockets around Jerusalem, for example, where Jesus taught, and of course in the Galilee. So it seems in the New Testament they followed him around as well, so they were quite well represented because maybe because of their opposition to his teaching, but not normative Judaism as has been seen from a traditional perspective. Then you have the Sadducees. So these are thoroughly Hellenized Jews, and they were kind of not enemies, but always in argument with the Pharisees, often debating each other. They often debated each other. So they rejected the oral interpretation of the Torah and the prophetic books of the Bible. They also rejected the Pharisees' beliefs in angels, divine intervention in human affairs, and the afterlife. So in the New Testament, we see, of course, that Jesus talks about the Sadducees. They don't believe in the afterlife. They don't believe in the resurrection. And that's exactly how it was in history. They didn't have this belief in the afterlife as the Pharisees did. So the focus was on the temple. So the focus on the temple, they supported the priests and this kind of elitism within the priesthood. And so because they were so disconnected from the people and so elitist in their approach, they disappear from the Jewish narrative in 60 CE, and also due to the Pharisees' opposition. So the Pharisees have become more popular by this time. And then the Pharisees were actually much more influential in the latter period rather than in the early period when they were forming their group. Yeah, so 60 CE, by 60 CE, the Pharisees are more influential. They're able to expel the Sadducees, you could say, from Judaism. Then you have Am Haaretz, or Amei Haaretz. So Am means the people, and then Amei is like the plural. So Amei Haaretz, Haaretz is like the country. So it means the people of the country, literally. So the people of the Haaretz in Hebrew means Israel. That's the word we use today. Even today we say Haaretz means the land, literally means the land, so the land of Israel. But in this case, yeah, it could mean Amei Haaretz means people of the land, the land of that area. So the rural masses in English. Yeah. So there's a lot of antagonism between Amei Haaretz and these Pharisees. So the Amei Haaretz were usually those who were less learned, those who were not as educated. Whereas the Pharisees, they were like bookworms. They were like very intelligent and very well educated, and so they're often in friction with each other. And this is seen in the New Testament, where they often criticize, for example, Jesus' disciples who come from Amei Haaretz, who are this kind of you could say country bumpkins. But like for you, it's a derogatory term. So they said that they didn't follow the dietary rules, they didn't keep the Sabbath properly, they were not pious enough. So this is well portrayed in the New Testament, this kind of antagonism between these two groups. And this is not just in the New Testament, also this goes back to Babylon itself. So it's revealed in the Babylonian Talmud. So the Talmud is the interpretation of the oral law, and it started in the, sorry, it was completed. The Babylonian Talmud was completed in the 5th century CE. So at the, sorry, in this, in the Babylonian Talmud, also it talks about, yeah, the Amei Haaretz, there are derogatory terms used to to describe them in comparison to how the Pharisees saw them, to how people, those of the law, teachers of the law, saw them. But on the other hand, also in the Babylonian Talmud, it says that the teachers of the law should not be too lofty and think that and too arrogant, but they should also learn from the people. So, but it shows this this tension between the two groups. So you have both the extra biblical texts of the Babylonian Talmud, the New Testament Gospels, both verify this antagonism. And then you have proselytes. So proselytes are converts to Judaism. And there may have been as many as up to 5 million, so 700,000 to 5 million in Palestine during the Hellenistic period, and from 2 million to 5 million in the diaspora. Yeah, so quite a lot of, a very large number actually of Gentiles who converted to Judaism, and estimates of 1/10 of the Mediterranean being Jewish at one time. Yeah, so that's a very large percentage of the population. There are also Jewish sympathizers, so who were not proselytizers. So these are called sebomenoi, which means fearers of the Lord, those who feared the Lord, kind of righteous Gentiles, you could say, those who had sympathy for the Jewish faith and for the Jewish people, but were not converts themselves. So also that was a large, there's a large number of these people as well in both inside Israel and outside in the diaspora. So if you look at the, what were the kind of, so we've been talking about Hellenistic cultural influences, but what kind of, and what kind of depth, so what kind of types and what kind of depth did these forms of Hellenization have on Jewish culture? So in the Talmud itself, you have 2,500 or up to 3,000 Greek words. So these are kind of loan words, and these words are related to the fields of law, government, science, religion, technology, daily life. So to all parts of almost Jewish life. So within the Talmud, you find those Greek words. That's one form of influence. Also, sermons were preached by rabbis that were translated into Greek. So for the Greek-speaking audience, these sermons would have been translated. Also in ossuaries. So ossuaries are, maybe you know, they're like, do you know what an ossuary is? The, it's like a box made of stone. For Jewish people, when they die, the body is not kept in the coffin. It's kind of it's left in a cave, in an enclosed cave, and then the body rots, and then the bones are taken. They put the bones inside a stone box called an ossuary, and then you seal it with a lid. So you put a lid on top, and then so that, yeah, that's what an ossuary is. So these ossuaries had inscriptions in Greek. So even though they were made, they are Jewish graves, but they had some names or some titles in Greek on those, written on those ossuaries. Also you find Greek papyri in Dead Sea caves. So the Dead Sea caves, of course, are very important for preserving the Jewish scriptures, both in Hebrew and Greek. But you find quite a large number of Greek papyri found in those Dead Sea caves alongside the Hebrew manuscripts. Also Greek names for rabbis. So rabbis adopted Greek names. There was a Greek school of Greek wisdom, so kind of a religious school of Judaism based on Greek wisdom, established in the 2nd century CE. Synagogues were also stylized on Hellenistic Roman temples. So that picture we saw, that mosaic we saw at the beginning from Sepphoris, is an example of that, how the synagogue, you can see the style of it or the temple there was based on a Greek style Roman temple. Yeah, so here we say Hellenistic Roman temple. That means it's a temple for the Roman religion, which is thoroughly Hellenized in style. And also, of course, Roman religion borrowed many Greek gods as well and just named them different things. So you have, that's why when we say Roman religion, we're actually talking about a mixture, strictly speaking, of Greek religion and Roman religion. Yeah, there are also stories concerning rabbis which parallel Socrates and Cynic narratives, so taken from Greek narratives. So stories also, maybe metaphors borrowed from Greek culture. There's also dialogue between rabbis and Greek and Roman philosophers. So there was dialogue happening between Greek and Jewish philosophers, and also Roman philosophers. So it would seem that Jewish culture was influenced to quite a degree by Hellenistic culture on the surface. But if you look at it at a deeper level, Judaism retained much of its distinctiveness. So, for example, very few embraced Gnosticism. So, Gnosticism being the belief that you can become united with God, you can become God yourself through a mystic experience. That was rejected by almost all Jews. Yeah, the Greek philosophers Plato and Aristotle are never mentioned by rabbis or even strongly Hellenized Jews. So these two kind of pillars of Greek philosophy were not ever mentioned in Jewish writing. And Greek philosophical terms were never used, which is interesting. So they had this Greek school for Greek wisdom, but somehow avoided using Greek philosophical terms to teach them. So maybe coaching this Greek philosophy in Hebrew or Judaic terms to teach it instead. Yeah, so maybe the reason for this resilience of this core Judaic religion was perhaps due to the stronghold of Judea, so the stronghold of Jerusalem with the temple. As long as the temple was there, and the many schools of the early schools of rabbinical Judaism that were in Jerusalem, supporting the doctrine based on the temple, as long as that was there, then that would propagate Judaism and the core values, the core ideas in Judaism, which did not change despite this surface level Hellenization. So it's kind of similar to what we've been saying all along earlier in the biblical account as well, with the patriarchs, for example, encountering the Canaanite religion, later on encountering the religion of the Egyptians under the pharaohs. And then again, later in Israel, going back to Israel, and then in the northern kingdom of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah, encountering the different pagan religions there also, we see that Judaism never disappeared, but instead it became maybe culturally adapted to these different conditions without losing its core ideas and values. So if you look at talk about Hellenistic Judaism in diaspora in a moment, but first we'll focus on Hellenistic Judaism in Palestine or in Israel. So if you look at the temple and the priesthood, as we will see in the documentary later, and also as you've seen in the readings, so Herod the Great Herod was very important for rebuilding, not just rebuilding, but greatly expanding the temple in Jerusalem. So he rebuilt it and expanded it even to much greater proportions after the Roman general Pompey invaded Jerusalem in 106 to 48 BCE and desecrated it in 63 BCE. Yeah, so Pompey, he came with his army, and this is the downfall of the Seleucid. So we're talking about the Seleucid Empire before. So then the Romans came and took over from the Seleucids, taking over Israel and Jerusalem. And Pompey was in charge of the Jerusalem, the campaign against Israel and Jerusalem. So Herod appeared to be a kind of, he had Jewish blood by default, you could say. He was not really Jewish originally. His father had converted to Judaism. He was actually an Edomite. And then Herod liked to claim that Jewishness for his own benefit, basically. He was not a really observant Jew, really observing Judaism. He used it more for his own political gain. And as we will see in the weeks to come, he married a Jewess from the Hasmonean lineage. So Hasmoneans going back to the Maccabees. And by marrying this princess, he then was able to claim himself to be from the Hasmoneans, and therefore the rightful ruler of the Jews in Judea. So this is kind of a political ploy that he used to his favor. So anyway, he wanted to portray himself as kind of a benevolent king to the Jews. And so he said, I'll build this grand temple for you, and it'll be even grander than any of the temples before in Jerusalem. I'll lavish it with great wealth and make it a place for all nations to come and worship at. So on top of that, so he built a temple, then he appointed these high priests for his own political and financial gain as well. So he put those in place who would favor his rule, who would say nice things about him. And then this actually eventually led to a class warfare that erupted in 59 CE. Between these high priests appointed by Herod and then the regular priests and the leaders of the population in Jerusalem. So it was a class warfare between those who were favored by the king, starting with Herod, and then who were given these favors over the regular priests and the rest of the people. So at this time, so we have the temple and the priesthood on the one hand becoming very wealthy, very powerful, but on the other hand not being considered the central spiritual kind of a center of Judaism by some. And so in their place, synagogues arose. This became very common in addition to the centrality of the temple. And as we said last week, they may have their foundations in 6th century Babylonian exile. So being in Babylon during exile, the Jewish people had to find ways without the temple to find communal ways to worship. And so these synagogues became centers for that kind of communal worship without the temple. And then once later on here, in this case where the priesthood and the temple, or at least the priesthood is corrupt, then these synagogues can become alternative places of authenticity for Judaism. So the temple was still definitely very important because everyone went up there every year, for example on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, to sacrifice for their sins. This was a very important event for everyone in Jewish religion, and not just from Israel, but those from the diaspora also would return to Jerusalem to come for example, for Yom Kippur and other important festivals to the temple. So it wasn't that the temple was not important, it was still very important, but the priesthood was increasingly seen as being corrupt and not for the people. So at this time, also under Hellenistic influence, the legislative and judicial spheres of Judaism were also heavily influenced. So for example, the Great Sanhedrin or the Council Court, which included the Sadducees, this was an important institution in Judaism at this time. So members of the Sanhedrin, they initially governed alongside the king during the Hasmonean dynasty. So they were able to partake in the governance of Judah and Israel at that time under the Hasmonean. So the Hasmonean meaning back in the time of the Maccabees, during that revolt, after the Maccabee revolt, and subsequently the Hasmonean kings who took over in the lineage of the Maccabees. Yeah, during that period of the Hasmonean dynasty, the great Sanhedrin was able to govern side by side and inform those kings, those Hasmonean kings, how to govern properly. But with Herod's reign, with Herod coming to power, he restricted this authority to religious authority alone, so they could no longer have any say in governance. They were restricted only to religious affairs. Yeah, so a separate Sanhedrin was also established by the high priest for the political council and jury. Yeah, so had at the beginning more involvement in governance, then later on only for religious affairs, and then a separate Sanhedrin for their own internal political council and jury. It was not a very influential council on the government as it had been originally. So this is the second temple under Herod, kind of a model of that. As you can see, very grand, covered in gold, and you have these palladiums either side of the temple where people could gather to debate philosophy and so forth. And also within one of these palladiums, you had the Sanhedrin, which would gather. So the Sanhedrin, the council, would also gather in the courtyards of the temple to discuss different deliberations as well. So a very grand design, much bigger, much more impressive than the first temple. And actually, we'll see the documentary later about how they designed this temple is quite interesting. The architecture and the thought that went into this was very precise and very elaborate. So on top of the temple, you had synagogues, as we said. Synagogues became increasingly common and popular at this time. This is the synagogue at Capernaum. So do you remember in Capernaum in the New Testament, there's quite a few stories surrounding this synagogue. Yeah, so Jesus taught here on quite a few different occasions. He gave a discourse on the bread of life. He said, I am the bread of life, that discourse that happened at this synagogue. Yeah, also the driving out of the evil spirit from a man. This also happened at Capernaum at this synagogue. So this is not actually the original synagogue. This is a 4th century CE synagogue at Capernaum, but it's almost certainly the place on top of which, under the foundations here, you'll find the original synagogue, because synagogues were often built on top of each on top of the old foundations of the original synagogue. So this is not the original synagogue, but only about 300 years after Jesus. And the original synagogue in which he taught in is underneath in the foundations. So I've been here quite a few times to Capernaum. It's very very impressive. Like you walk through here and see the kind of synagogue that Jesus taught in, and it's exactly the same place where he was. So it's quite a special experience, especially if you are a Christian, to be in that place. So you'll see his discourse on the bread of life teaching. That's in John 6:22-59. Also in Luke, it talks about Jesus being in the synagogue quite regularly. Healing happened. He also teaches and heals here in Mark. And it also talks about him going from Nazareth and actually settling in Capernaum for some time. So he actually stayed, not just taught, but he stayed and lived in the area for some time during his teaching. So these are kind of the places we are talking about, these communal places of worship that were increasingly popular with Jews in addition to the temple. Before, we talked about the Hasmonean dynasty. So Hasmoneans were from the Maccabees. So this starts with Mattathias and his five sons. And then the lineage comes from his son Simon, and then Judas, Hyrcanus, so this is a Greek name, sorry, not Hebrew, so it's harder to say. And it goes all the way down to Herod the Great, who married Mariamne the First, who was a Jewish princess, and that's how he got himself into the lineage and said, "I am from the Hasmoneans originally," and that's how he curried favor with the Jews, one of his ways, and then building the temple, of course, as we just said. But not a very nice person, as we'll find out in weeks to come, quite a tyrant as well. Okay, let's have a break for maybe, let's say, 10 minutes and come back to, give the mind some rest as well.